Tonight we want to start with Romans chapter 6, verses 8 through 11. We've talked about sin. Paul will have some more things to say about sin. And we have three good verses here to start tying all that together. He begins with a contrast to Romans 6, 8. He says, But if we died with Christ, we believe that we shall also live with him, knowing that Christ, being raised from the dead, dieth no more. Death no more hath dominion over him. For, he says, the death that he died unto sin once. But the life that he liveth unto God. Even so, ye also yourselves be dead unto sin, but alive unto God in Jesus Christ. As you look at the end of verse 9, Paul says that death no longer rules over Jesus Christ. We are going to see that word rule a couple of the times in the book of Romans. You're going to see it in Romans chapter 7 and verse 1. The next chapter, you're also going to see it in Romans chapter 14 and verse 9. Outside the New Testament, that word was associated with one, and I'm going to give you the quote here, the one who had the rights to produce to the produce of some land the harvest from a certain territory, or the owner of a slave or a house of or house and property. So here the idea, Paul is saying, look, death, Jesus has defeated it. He was ruled over that by that temporarily. He goes down into the Hadean realm, Acts chapter 2, but that is no longer the case. And he's making the point that Jesus' physical death was what ruled over him for a period of time. That's no longer the case. What kind of death ruled over us for a period of time?
Sin.
All right, or that spiritual death, sin. But just as Jesus was able to conquer physical death, that's no longer a problem for him. Guess what? We are also able to overcome sin. Now, for us, that, and that's why the book of Revelation talks about being an overcomer. Now, for us, the overcoming is not in the sense that, sin is not still a problem for us. We do still sin, but sin no longer reigns over us. It no longer rules over us. It is no more our God. It is no more our master, unless we want to go back and live in that particular way. We certainly do not want to forget about sin. We're going to see that a little bit later. In Romans chapter 8, Paul's going to talk about living after the flesh. He talks about the mind of the flesh. He says that is death, so we can go back and pursue that. And we all do slip at times. You may remember from Galatians chapter 6 and verse 1, Paul said, even if any man, remember the rest of it, it's joined with sin. But even if a brother is in any trespass, ye who are spiritual restore such a one. But if anyone is overtaken, remember that word? Anybody has been someone who succumbed to sin, they went back to that way of life, do not do that. But Paul is trying to convey to Christians here in Romans chapter 6, make a deliberate break with sin. Leave it alone. This is supposed to be a one-time act for you. Our master is God. The devil is no longer our master. As you look at verse 11, you begin to see in the first part of that verse, he talks about being dead unto sin. But if you're dead unto sin, what's the opposite of that? What should be true for us? You've made that commitment as far as putting away sin, so now you are...
Live to God.
What was the first word?
Live to God.
Okay, live. Some of the translations would use the word alive. You are now alive spiritually, so you need to live for God. That's expressed with the present tense. When you look at the word which is rendered reckon, that's a word where you would, if you're looking at the original word, you would see the word logic reflected in that. It means consider yourselves dead. Think about this. Reckon this. Count this. Consider this. When Paul said that Jesus died, he says that Jesus died once. There's that word over in Jude 3, hapax. It is a word which means once for all. Remember, the faith was delivered once for all. You can sometimes take a word and you can strengthen the word. You can add a little bit. Usually on the beginning of it, you can add a prefix to the word and you intensify it. Well, you have an intensification here. When Paul says that Jesus died, he says he not only died once, but he died once for all time. That's something that's never going to be repeated. There is nothing on heaven and earth that would ever cause Jesus to die once more. So you have here, I think, an emphasis on the singularity as well as the uniqueness of Jesus' death. And there's also perhaps a contrast. When you think about the Old Testament and death, as far as death and sacrifices, what comes to mind? Frequency. I mean, it was just day after day after day after day. Can you imagine being a Jew? And one day in the synagogue, somebody says, I want to talk to you about sacrifice. Well, you're thinking, all right, we've heard all those Bible studies before. But this person who stands up and says, I want to talk to you about a one-time sacrifice. And it's not just a one-time sacrifice. It is a one-time sacrifice that will eliminate all the other sacrifices that we've been accustomed to offering. Can you imagine, if you were a Jew, what that message would have been like that day? I mean, that would have been the day where you would have said, if that guy is telling me the truth, that was the most amazing sermon I've ever heard. I mean, I struggled to believe that one guy could give his life and that would wipe out the entire sacrificial system. So if you are someone who's an apostle, you're going around, you're preaching that, and then you start raising the dead and doing some other signs, probably going to get a lot of attention. Steve?
Back in those times, those people lived hundreds of years. The lifespan was over. So they would have been involved or saw tens of thousands of sacrifices.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, when you think about
it. Even if you're going from 500 sacrifices to just the one for all time, that's significant. But you're probably talking about thousands for some of these people.
Yeah, for you think about prior to things began to change after the flood. But you think about the people who were trying to do what was right, and you know the sacrifices that they are offering, and the number of years that they live.
Even if they did it once a week.
Yes.
For they lived to be 300 years old.
Yeah. It was a lot, and certainly for the Jews. So this was an amazing thing. Anybody else ever thought about that? Don?
In Jesus' time, the life of that time was more like our time. Right?
Or less, yes.
So they had the old scripture to go by, the Old Testament to go by, and what Steve was talking about. But, you know, that was all ingrained into them, especially the Pharisees, Sadducees, and all those. But the Jew that was not an official in a synagogue or anything like that was much easier to win over than the ones that are ingrained in, wasn't it? Because they didn't want to give up all the sacrifices that
you're
supposed to.
Yeah. It's funny how sometimes burdens are things that people want to bear. You think about it, and I'm thinking about sometimes some older people who are not senile, but they really struggle to do some things. And because they struggle to do some things, they complain. Oh, boy, you know, my house is so big, it kills me to clean it. Boy, it kills me to mow my yard. Well, you could move. There's this place. Oh, no, I wouldn't move. Isn't it interesting that when you look at people, they complain about stuff, but if you show them that there's another way, no, I want to hold on to that. And you, I think, almost see that done with the Jews. Oh, these sacrifices, the burden.
We have an outlet. We have it today. Everybody said, no, I can't change. I'm set in my ways.
Yeah.
And they were set in their ways. So, I agree with you.
It is tough because people, even though they complain, on one level they do like what they're doing. Paul says, as he talks to these Christians, let's go back to verse 9 a little bit, he says, you know this information. No, the tense there is significant. He uses the perfect tense. You have known and you continue to know this information. When you think about life, are there some things that fall into that category for us still? I mean, we learn them, and even now, years later, I mean, we know. There are a lot of things that we forget. I mean, we might... Anybody remember their address from 40 years ago? Good for you. All right. You know, there are some people... Maybe you're still at the same place, and that helps you a little bit. Now, Lois is not. But there are some things that you forget over the years. Teresa and I, we had a discussion. She brought out some Christmas ornaments, and we had one that we did. We both remembered that a piece had been broken off, and we fixed it. We also both remembered that we really liked that ornament. We did not agree on who gave it to us about 35 years ago. I think I won that discussion, and I think I'm right. But again, you know, after 35 years, that Christmas ornament wasn't something that was, you know, in the same category as necessarily the combination to a safe. What else? Things that we try to file away and we say, boy, we remember that.
Ask an ex-military person what his service number is.
Yeah. Yeah. What was the Air Force was an AFSC. Or MOS, I think, is in the Army. I'm not sure about the Marine Corps. But yes, and I mean, they can probably just rattle it off like that. And they'll give you the numbers or they'll give you the letters and... mine was, for example, a B shred, a 702B. But, people just don't forget that. What else? People, they can just rattle it off.
I remember my hat here.
All right. There are some people, they remember that particular day, and they can tell you just about the hour. They certainly remember the place. They remember the people who were involved there, the people perhaps who came, certainly the man who baptized the individual, all those things. What else? Things that you know.
I remember when Maxine and I got married.
All right.
And where?
Well, that'll probably score you a couple of extra pieces of chocolate on the way home on it. So, but a lot of people will, you know, you remember the day of your child's birth. You remember the day of your wedding. You may remember the date that someone died. There are all kinds of things. Well, Paul says, look, this is in your memory. Well, what's in your memory, Paul? He said you left sin behind. Just as Jesus died, you died to sin. And now you are alive unto God. Now, what do you think is going to happen if people don't keep that in their memory?
Go back into sin.
They're going to go back into sin. And what about their commitment to Christ? It's not going to be all that strong. But this was something that you might say was drilled into the minds of these people. Paul believed that that was very, very important. Okay, anything that you want to touch base on before we deal with Romans 6 and verse 12? Okay, let's take a look there. He says, with the therefore, let not sin therefore reign in your mortal body, that ye should obey the lusts thereof. Well, this conclusion is fairly obvious in light of what we've already said, but Paul, bringing the things to a head, says, therefore, he says, I don't want you to let sin reign, that is expressed with the present tense, in your body, in your mortal body. Thayer, in defining that word, reign, used the word to exercise the highest influence to control. How do we see sin reigning, influencing to the point of controlling people? All right, sometimes it's an obsession. And there are various, a lot of sins fall into that particular category. I am so consumed, my thoughts are so just attached to this, that I'm not going to leave it alone until I do it. How else?
Do anything power.
All right, there are some people who, if we're looking at power, especially sinful power, they will commit all the resources to it. They will invest all their mental energy and perhaps exhaust all their sources of friends and perhaps expend a great deal of money. How else? Sin reigns in the body. It controls people. What about anger? Do you think anger can influence a person to the point where it controls someone?
Yeah.
After an evil deed happens, what does a person say? I lost control. Well, they're right. That's absolutely correct. How else does sin reign in the body?
We take the supper every first day of the week because we don't want to forget. Remember that. If we don't come to the assembly with other believers, Bible study, worship hour, and we say, oh, well, it doesn't really make that much difference. I'm a solid Christian, so I'm but down the road, that sort of gets weaker and weaker and weaker. You're not such a solid Christian anymore. You forget. If you didn't do it every Sunday or every Wednesday, then in your mind, it drifts off and doesn't really make that much difference.
Yeah, sin is sneaky. It may not seem all that great today or tomorrow, but it has that snowball effect. And when you start looking at things like commitment, and you can tie attendance in there, you can tie giving in there, and that's not necessarily the giving of money. You can say the giving of time or trying to help out, whatever that is. It just begins to grow and mushroom, and finally it consumes a person, and it overwhelms them. And Paul says, do not do that. You have been taught better, and you know better. As he talks about this spiritual battle, he uses the word mortal. Now that's an interesting word, because in classical Greek, that word was used to contrast man with God, the God of the Bible, or man with gods. Here, what do you think he's trying to say? There is this problem of sin. Jesus overcame it. You can overcome it as well. But this sin, this transgressing God's will, this thing that can control your life, he says, watch out when it comes to your mortal body. What's he saying? Well, I'll give you a hint. Mortal sounds like it's really strong or not so strong?
Well, it's strong if you're human. It's not divine.
Correct. So you are going to, if you're mortal, you're going to die. And that means that you are subject to some things, including being overcome by sin. So it's another way.
It's less than immortal.
Yes. Yes. So it's another way to say you are, in many respects, a very frail creature. You need to watch out for the problem of sin. You have a couple of the key words in this verse. One is obey. The other is going to be the word lust. We're going to see that word obey again. That's going to be in Romans 6 and verse 12, just not far from where we are. We'll see it in Romans 6:16, 6:17, and also in the 10th chapter, Romans chapter 10 and verse 16. Here, as you might imagine, it is expressed with the present tense. Paul uses the noun form of that in places like Romans chapter 1 and verse 5. Back there, he said that God has given a faith and that faith needs to be obeyed. Here the sense is to allow oneself to be captivated by or governed by something. It is, once again, the idea that there is this sin, there is this particular path, and he says, do not obey the lust thereof. We have a choice, do we not, when it comes to obeying sin? I mean, it's put right out there, and it's made really attractive. And we can decide, okay, we're going to go down that road because we like what's offered, or we think we can get away with it, or we don't think it's going to be that bad. And sometimes it comes back to really bite us. You also have another source that defines biblical words. They said, as far as disobedience, to which one is obedient or which one embraces in full surrender. I like that definition. I don't know that I typically think about sin like that, but let's pause for just a minute and consider sin in those terms. Surrendering to sin. How does that work? Now, that's similar to the question that I asked before. Surrendering to sin. How does that work? Gary?
Well, to surrender is to let go, to cower down and let it overtake you, and it wins over you.
Okay, so that's right. But let's narrow that down a little bit and be a little more specific. How do you do that? You, I think we're headed in the right direction as far as giving a specific example. What happens if you're tempted to lie or cheat or steal?
If you could stand up
again. All right, you resist it for a time, but maybe you see some other people doing it. Maybe it doesn't seem to be that bad, or maybe the circumstances are going to get, you know, pretty difficult for you unless you lie. So finally you just say, well, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to
give
in. There you go. Those two words. I'm going to give in. I'm going to surrender. And that's what then that's what happens. You surrender to sin. How else do people surrender to sin? What about gossip? Can you surrender to sin by gossip? I mean, all that juicy stuff is being said. People are telling some great stories. And you've got some to share as well. So perhaps you're thinking, I really shouldn't. But too good not to share, right? And you jump in the pool. How else do people surrender to sin?
You can surrender to sin simply by standing by and doing nothing.
Yeah. A passive surrender. Do you think that, along with individuals, a congregation can surrender to sin?
Oh, absolutely.
How? It can be a moral problem. You have that at Corinth. It can be a doctrinal problem. You find that, for example, in the book of Revelation with the seven churches. And people were given the opportunity to stand up and do what was right. But as Stan said, sometimes it's passive and sometimes it's not. Sometimes the people are openly welcome. I mean, they not only surrender, they just throw down the arms and open up the city gates and say, come on in. We will be glad to join hands with you. We want to be in fellowship with you. So we've got to be really careful, not only individually, but we also want to think about this congregationally. We'll also say a little bit about the word lust here. We saw that back in Romans chapter 1 and verse 24 when Paul was talking about the Gentiles. So as you look at what's going on here, he portrays the body not as something that is inherently evil, but he does say, look, there is potential here. We are weak, we are frail people, and we can surrender to sin, and oftentimes when that's done, there are going to be some consequences. And God forgives, and sometimes the consequences take a little while to work through, but thankfully, they can be. Anything that you want to touch base on before we pick up with verse 13? Betty may have hand-to-hand, but Gary will take yours first.
Verse 12 says that they're obeying the sin, and we use the word obey in such a strong, I mean, I feel we use that word quite strongly and quite regularly, meaning we need to obey God and His will. So to think of it as someone obeying sin, that's, it's a big force, and it's telling you to do something, and you're doing it. And then there's the people that say, you know, I don't have time for God, I don't have time for the church. they're obeying something else, and that's where they're putting their importance.
Yeah, obedience for accountable people is in one of two realms. God, or the way of the world, and the devil. That's it. That's what Scripture affirms. And again, you're right, people do not necessarily see it in those terms. They're thinking, I'm going my own way, doing my own thing, and I'm being a pretty good person. Well, God says you can see it that way, but that is not an accurate portrayal of your life. Betty, did you have a hand or not? Okay, that it? I'm sorry, Tim, I almost missed you back there.
Peer pressure.
Sure. As far as obeying sin and surrendering?
Yeah, especially for young people.
Yeah. Yeah. You think about some of the invitations that they get. You think about some of the activities that they're involved with. And oftentimes they're good kids. You know, church kids. And mom and dad come along. Why did you do that? Why? They don't use the word surrender, but that's really what mom and dad are saying. Why did you surrender? We taught you better. You don't hang around with those kinds of people normally. You don't talk like that. We don't support that. You know, you've been to services all your life. Why? Well, the answer is in Romans chapter 6. We surrendered. Peer pressure may have been one of the factors, or maybe it was the sole factor there. But people, we're going to see this a little later in Romans chapter 12. Remember verses 1 and 2? Paul said, I beseech you therefore by the mercies of God to present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service. But be ye transformed, what? By the renewing of your mind. You've got to look at sin and say, it's tempting sometimes. I really want to go there. I really want to do that. But I have chosen to obey God. Remember Romans chapter 6, I've made that one-time commitment. And keep that before our minds. Keep calling ourselves back to that, that God has created a holy people. But the old devil is there and doing the very best that he can to say, come on over here and just surrender at least for a little while. I've got some really good stuff for you. And it's tempting. And all of us get hit with that at one time or another. Don, and then we'll take Betty's hand.
When you use the word tempted, I'm not trying to put you in a corner.
Okay.
Are you saying that basically we're drawn to that we'd like to do that, even though we know it's a sin? Or we're drawn to it because we don't really know if it's a sin or not?
I think you have both. When you look at Adam and Eve, especially Eve, I think that she's probably in the category of she'd notice the fruit. That seems to me to be something that you pick up from her life. But would she have actually eaten the fruit without some help from Satan? That to me is the million-dollar question. He certainly was willing to further that along, and he certainly seemed uninterested. He certainly did not seem to want to go down the road of just letting her, go where she will, and then maybe she finds it, and maybe she tries it, and maybe not. So I think, Don, you have to, as you look at those two possibilities that you laid out, say that they're both true. There are going to be some times where people are just curious, and going back to Tim's point as far as young people, sometimes they're just curious. You know, they've never been exposed to drugs or drinking or fornication or pornography or smoking or maybe foul language. They've never been exposed to a gang, those kinds of things. And it's kind of like, well, that, you know, what's going to be the harm in going and looking? But then there's some other people who, for whatever reason, they're predisposed, or maybe they've heard about something, or maybe the internet has exposed them somehow, and they actively, or at least more actively, want to search that out. But temptation comes in all kinds of forms. Betty, to you.
In work situations and social situations that are shoved at us as adults, that a lot of times the adults succumb to, who's had a lot more experience even than the high school or college kid, but we still succumb, enough peer pressure is put against us.
We've seen that, I think, politically. For the last 4 years with President Trump, for the people who were enthused about him, they were very enthused about him, and the people who were not, they felt some peer pressure. And now as things switch, on the other side of things, there have been some people who are very enthused about President Biden, and now as the shoe is on the other foot, so to speak, I think we're going to see the opposite of that. And in places like work or other social settings, having some conversations, maybe it's just in the PTA, there is that social pressure where people feel like, well, I don't want to speak up because everybody, you know, supports or did support or is now supporting this particular one, and I'm going to be in the minority. Or something comes up that's a moral issue or a religious issue. There are 10 people in the group. 9 of the people are supporting something. You're the only one who is not in support of that. Abortion could be an example of that. Are you going to stand up against the 9, so to speak? So peer pressure is all around us. And I don't think that we ever, even in a nursing home, I don't think that we ever completely free ourselves from peer pressure.
Yeah, and now you've got what they call the cancel culture going around. And so a lot of people bow to that to keep from being canceled, as they say.
But that stuff is not new. You think about Rome. All you have to do is pinch a little incense and say, Caesar's God. You do that, and you can buy, and you can sell, and you can have your business, and you can travel, and life is good. Just do that. Well, this is in a different area, but suppose that we get to the point where you have to have the vaccine, a vaccine to get on an airplane. You know, are you willing to do that? Well, a lot of people are, but there are going to be some people who would say, I'm not going to do that. And in the Christian realm, in the spiritual realm, it's the same kind of thing. You know, you just have to agree to do this, or just have to be quiet, and everything is going to be okay. But there again, going back and pinching the incense to Caesar, are you willing to pay the price, just as some people now may have to pay the price as far as getting a shot for the airplane? All right, that it, or anybody else? Let's take a look at Romans chapter 6 and verse 13.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, almost missed you.
Doesn't temptation assume some knowledge of wrong? You can't be tempted to do something that you don't know isn't wrong, can you?
Well, that's a really good question. Let's think about that for a second. What happens, I was going to use anger as an illustration. Can you be tempted if you don't know it's wrong?
And what made me think of that is you said that the vision of the forbidden fruit tempted Eve, and I don't really believe that's quite correct, wasn't it? Because she didn't know what it was. She was really tempted to disobey God. She knew what that was.
Let's go back and take a look. You got in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 1, the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, has God indeed said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden? The woman said to the serpent, we may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat, and you shall not touch it, lest you die. So she was certainly familiar with it, it seems like, before Satan comes along and begins to work on her.
She knew that to see it. Other than that, she had no experience with it.
Correct.
And she knew that God said she shouldn't eat it.
Correct. And then the serpent begins to work on her. Satan says, you're not going to die. God knows that, you know, when you eat that, you're going to be like him. And then in 6, so when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of it of its fruit and ate. Maybe I didn't express my point very well, but Don was asking, if I remember the question correctly, two different things. You can be in this position where I ended, and that is, hey, I want that. Or you can be in that less knowledgeable state, which is what I suggested, before Satan comes along. It seems like she was aware of it, but as far as much beyond that, not so much.
So, in other words, kids as they're growing up, yes, they're tempted to try drugs, even though they haven't a clue of what the drug is by experience, but they have some knowledge that it's not acceptable or that it's not good or whatever. So that's the reason I thought a person has to have some knowledge of what they're doing in order to be tempted by it.
Well, maybe we can use poison as an example. Person has to have some knowledge of temptation for it to be wrong. That is the question. Okay. Anybody want to take a shot at that while I'm trying to formulate my example?
Well, I'll take a shot at it.
Okay.
I think, Stan, what you're saying is, if you don't have any knowledge of it, then you can't be tempted. Is that right?
Well, yeah, it wouldn't...
Somewhat about that, somewhat.
You wouldn't be tempted by something that you did.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Gary?
I think you could be tempted, but your conscience wouldn't be bothered. So
that's really what we're looking at.
I think of like a strange traffic law that applies only in certain states. Like if there's a four-lane road and there's a car in the left lane and you can't pass it on the right lane, which is a new law in Indiana, then if you come here and you don't know that and the car in the left lane is going slow, you can be tempted to pass it in the right, whether or not you know that the law exists. But if you know the law exists, then your conscience could be bothered by wanting to pass it on the right.
Yeah, I think there are some facets to that question, Stan, that would really need to be fleshed out, probably around a table, rather than give you a really good answer in class. I'm willing to say at times I'm not prepared to answer that, and that doesn't hopefully happen too often, but tonight I'll go ahead and put that question in that category that we need to hash that around a little bit. But my basic answer is, I'm very hesitant to say that. I think we could find some exceptions to it. Probably few, but I do think that you would find at least a few. So a thoughtful question, and maybe we'll kick better on some. Anybody else before Romans? Tim, did you have a thought or not?
I was just thinking about Eve. Don't you think that she was tempted to become as wise as the Lord when Satan told her that?
Sure.
I mean, that to me, that was her temptation right there.
Yeah.
She already looked at it. She already liked the way it looked. She already figured it was good for food because she was told not to eat it. So she knew it was possible to eat it. But her temptation to me seemed like she wanted to be as wise as God.
Yeah, I mean, that's already out of the box. And maybe to kind of go back to what Stan was saying, temptation is generally out of the box, so to speak, to some degree. You know, there's something there that we can see. Now, how far do we have to get? For example, when the, let's use a teenager, 19 years old, invited to a party that's going to involve great temptation. Now, you're going to be the teenager, okay? Now, you've never been to this kind of party. So, we'll just play this out for just a minute. We'll role play for a second. I say, Stan, this coming Friday, there's a party. Do you want to go?
And I know what this party...
No, I'm just giving you a general invitation. You have no knowledge. I'm approaching you blindly.
Okay. Well, my first thought would be, okay, you know, what's the party?
It's a great party. One like you've never been to before.
I could be convinced to.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
All right. Now, you've moved into the area of temptation, right?
Set myself up for it.
Yes, you have. Now, how far do we have to go with the invitation? You know, we drive over to the place, and you see a lot of loud music, and you see some beer bottles out there. Mm-hmm. Now, you've never had alcohol before. Your parents have told you to never drink. You're a good church kid. Now, where does the temptation start? Is it looking over there and thinking, oh, hey, I wonder what that is? And maybe you don't even know what a beer bottle is. And then you get out, and you start seeing some people stumble around a little bit. Now, maybe it's just a matter of curiosity at that point. You know, remember James talks about temptation being full grown. And maybe that helps us a little bit as far as answering that question. How far out of the box do you have to be before you really start? Temptation at some point does become full grown. People oftentimes bite at that particular point in time. And then he says that brings forth death. That's the problem. But all the steps that are involved... Like I say, there are just so many variables there as far as in your case, you knew nothing, and the question was presented in such a way where it still left you in the dark, but the further you get down that road, the more you begin, if you don't have the knowledge, the more you begin to at least say, I have at least a little bit of an inkling. You know, people stumbling around and running out in front of cars, chances are this is not a good place to be.
Yes, and so I can see that. You could put temptation as far as recognition on the one end. There's suspicion. On the other end, you know.
Yes.
And there's that.
Yeah, and it's a process, basically. I think that's maybe the best answer that we can give to the question that you raised.
Yeah.
All right, good for you. Thank you. Okay, Romans chapter 6 and verse 13, he says, continuing, neither present yourselves unto sin as instruments of unrighteousness, but there's a contrast again. You know, we've already talked about this sin problem, so you present yourselves unto God as alive from the dead and your members as instruments of righteousness unto God. Well, Paul goes back to that idea of unrighteousness. We saw that back in Romans chapter 1, verse 18 with the Gentiles. God, his wrath, it brought down judgment on the Gentiles because of unrighteousness. We saw it in Romans 1:29. We saw it with the Jews in Romans chapter 2 and verse 8. And then when he talks about sin in all people, Jews and Gentiles, he used it again in Romans chapter 3 and verse 5. This unrighteousness is the result. This unrighteousness is the consequence of sin. And when you have that unrighteousness because of sin, guess what shows up? God's wrath. It's not good. So this is a very, very serious thing. We choose, as far as receiving or avoiding God's wrath, we choose our course by deciding what our members are going to do. And that word members simply means our body parts. We can sin with virtually every part of our body. There have been people who have sinned with their nose, and we don't have to get into the specifics of that. I don't know how you'd sin with your toes. I probably don't want to get into the specifics of that one either. But just any body part that you can imagine, people can sin with. And Paul says you use your members, you use your body parts in a good way. When you look at the word instrument, it's an interesting word. It's used twice in this verse, and it carries with it the idea of a weapon. We're not going to have a lot of time to develop this, but I do want to make at least a couple of points. That same word, you can, if you want cross-references, John 18 and verse 3, and also in 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 4, it's a word which indicates that there is a battle. And that battle is a battle which involves sin. We have to be, if we are, on one side of that battle or not, if we are accountable people. In this particular case, you find that God and the devil are both using people all around the world. And we can either be a human being who uses our instrument, our body parts, in the army of God, or we can use our body parts in the army of the devil. And when somebody says, well, I'm going to use my body parts for self, God says you've made a decision, and you have that right. You've decided to use your body parts for the devil. Now, there are a lot of people, I think probably the majority of people would say, oh, no, I'm not using my body parts for the devil. I'm using my body parts for me. Well, that may be how you see things, but there is a bigger picture, and there is that ongoing war. You may remember in Matthew chapter 12 and verse 30 that Jesus said, he that is not with me is against me. There is no middle ground there. The King James, and if you have some newer translations, you'll see the word instruments, I think, in this context, because warfare isn't exactly in the context. But Paul, as he's talking about this struggle, it was the appropriate word for him to use. We are going to see over in Romans chapter 13 and verse 12 in a context which is more militaristic, that the King James there does use armor when presenting this word. Keep in mind the conflict that's being discussed. All right, Paul, as he talks about this in verse 13, he discourages people from allowing themselves to be used in Satan's service. He says, do not present your members, do not present your body parts to sin. If you do that, he says, you're letting your life, your body, be used as one of Satan's instruments. The devil is using you as a weapon. Can you think of any time in the Lord's life when the devil used someone as a weapon against Jesus? A person let their body be used as a weapon against Christ, an apostle.
Judas.
All right. A couple of you got that, I think, at the same time. And certainly a very effective weapon as far as bringing about the Lord's death. Anybody else? Yeah, that was the other one that popped into mind. Remember Matthew chapter 16, I believe, Jesus said, get behind me, Satan, because Peter said, you know, we're not going to let that happen. You're not going to go to Jerusalem and die. And Jesus said, the devil is using you. If we are someone who is a Christian, we have been made alive from the dead. That means that we've been resurrected from the problem and the depths of sin. Paul talked about in Ephesians chapter 2, he said that you were dead in sin, you were dead in your trespasses, but through Christ we are made alive. Anybody remember from that first part of Romans chapter 6, how we're made alive with Christ, brought out of sin by what process? We're baptized into Christ. We are buried. We talked about that. It is immersion. We're raised to walk in the newness of life. And then God puts us in this service, a service of righteousness. Paul, as he worded his thought, it could be understood as stop presenting, no longer present, and the presentation of your body to Satan to be used in this particular way. We are soldiers in a new army. Our interests have changed. And now, rather than help Satan, rather than support Satan, we want to think about how to defeat him, his schemes, and how to bring more people into God's army. If you are in the service and you are not a good soldier, how are you classified? What are some things that you can do to make you a bad soldier? Military says you are?
W-L.
All right. AWOL, what's that?
W-L.
Absent without leave. Can you be that way in the spiritual realm?
Sure.
God says, look, you know, we've got the army here, and where are you? I'm home watching TV in my pajamas. How well do you think that would go over in the Army and the Marine Corps? Probably not well. Do you think that there are cowards? And do you think that there are traitors in the military? There are. Can we have those problems in the church?
Yeah.
I mean, we talked about the peer pressure with Betty earlier. People are, you know, there's a problem of fear. And people can also be individuals who refuse to fight. Well, we prefer for somebody else to do that. And Paul said, do not do that. The consequence is going to be spiritual death. In the middle of verse 13, he talks about yielding or presenting our bodies. And there again, the idea is you present the body and you present that one for once for all. We'll stop there for now. Thank you very much.